You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 371. The Bad Duo is back in stereo style. Will we be joined by a third? Stay tuned to find out. Yes, this is Features Editor John Gentile. This is Punk News Podcast 371, and it's the Bad Duo is in effect. Just John and my main man here, Dynamite Adam White, managing editor Adam White. Adam White, I think we're losing touch, Adam. I think we're losing lot happening this week in the news. A lot happening with young people stuff and memes and buzzing and beeping and internet stuff. And I learned the definition of what a shit post is today. I thought that was just like a term people threw out that meant nothing, but it actually means something. And it's actually, there's even a shit posting culture. And Adam, I tried to read into it. I think we're losing touch, dude. I think we are getting old and losing touch. And I think we need to go back with our Fleetwood Mac records and just get locked in a room and listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd and maybe AC/DC's Razor's Edge album and just sit there and let it drift away.
John, I rarely get the sense that I'm completely out of the loop with what people are into. And generally, I like to feel that if I'm out of the loop, it's because I have chosen to be. Like, I don't know what's going on with like the emo revival, right? But I know it exists. I just don't like it. So I'm not going to go there, right? Like, I didn't like it in the first place. Yeah. There's nothing that appeals to me about it. So I am willfully making myself ignorant of that. What we're talking about, the things that have happened today, I have no idea what's going on. And I would like to think that I am at least somewhat savvy with what's going on the internet, given that like I work in that industry. I build things for the internet. John, we have a fucking podcast. We don't live in a cave, right? But yeah, so what's been going on today? So I don't even know the names of any of these people, and I guess it doesn't really matter. There is a prominent...
Anthony Fantano is the reviewer's name. His website... Well, actually, doesn't have a web... His YouTube channel is called The Needle Drop. And what he does is he reviews records of all genres, new records of all genres. He does about one review a day, and he's got somewhat of a following. And people were talking about how he's gigantic. I never got the impression that he was gigantic. I got the impression that he was sort of known, but I wouldn't say he's huge, but people are saying he's huge. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, okay, so there's this guy. John, just to contextualize ourselves here. Have you ever heard of this person before?
Yes, I have. And actually, I never really had one opinion of him one way or another, except for he briefly had an MTV2 show where he would interview bands. But like it was that gag where like the interview was completely pointless and no questions made any sense. And that infuriated me because I'm like, you've got these amazing musicians in front of you, but you're doing the same joke over and over and over when you could talk about substantive issues.
Oh, okay. So anyways, I had not heard of him at all. And I'm not saying that to mean that I think that this person isn't huge by any stretch. I'm under the impression, just based on what I've learned today, that this is an absolutely massive person and that he is part of this crop of YouTube personalities. And I've been calling them vloggers all day with like a V. I don't know. Like, is that like an old grandma name for them? Like, is that what people call these people?
I think they call them YouTube celebrities, but I think we should call them vloggers. And I think we should
vloggers. Like, I thought vloggers was a thing. Anyways. So I'm aware that there's a massive segment of the internet that I don't go to by virtue of me not being a video game person, right? So like I understand that the youth interact with a whole ton of like video game content, and I know that just by like going on to YouTube and if you go and click on like the trending, right, and seeing what people are listening to, like I know that there's like millions of people that are watching videos about, I don't know, Minecraft, or watching people, I don't even know the word for it, do that thing where they record themselves playing video games and talk about it. whatever that's called.
It's called like Twitch gaming.
Sure, sure, whatever. I'm old. Okay. I understand those things exist, and I understand why I am ignorant of them, because they're not my genre. Like, I am aware of them as much as I'm aware of, you know, who the major stars are in, say, like in the cricket universe, right? Like, I don't watch cricket. I know it exists. I know that to a certain segment of the human population, it's huge, and that within that subculture, there are major stars. Same thing for me in video games. Like, I get that.
Wait, Adam, you said you know who the stars of cricket are?
Well, I mean, I know as much of them, which is zero, as I know about who the major stars of recording yourself on YouTube from playing video games are. Like, I don't know who these people are either. Right?
You know who PewDiePie is, don't you?
That's the one exception, but it's not because of any of the content. It's only because he's shown up in the news for doing some horrible thing, right? So, but that's it. But I always thought that he was like that he was some sort of
anomaly,
like weird aberration.
Yeah, right?
Like that he wasn't like the norm. But from what today has proven to me is that there's this whole music reviewing on YouTube subculture that I am unaware of. I don't even seem to say like blissfully unaware of. Like, I am like just completely emotionlessly unaware of. And they are, I mean, I'm not John. That's the one thing that like that you and I have to take like a humble pill for here. We nothing we do at all ever reaches the audience levels of these YouTube music people.
That's true, man. That's true. Sad, right? But true. Like, sad but true.
Like you seem to dismiss this guy's audience, like fucking dwarfs our audience, right? So, but that's fine, and I don't begrudge that or anything.
I do.
And I don't even really know. I don't know the story or the controversy or anything like that. I mean, the story is that this guy was involved in some alt-right stuff, and then it's become part of some wider narrative about like are all these YouTube personalities actually you know, men's right activist scumbags and not, you know, not the liberal media personalities that they make themselves out to be. Like, I guess that's the narrative that's going on. But John, I don't fucking know, and I don't have any. I'm not going to pass any particular judgment on. Well, I mean, I'll pass judgment. You shouldn't be one of those people that makes you a shit heel. But I'm not gonna pass any judgment on this personality in particular, because I don't know. I didn't know who he was before like 3 hours ago. Right?
Adam, you know why we don't know?
Why?
We got jobs. We're grown ass men. We're going to work. We're not screwing around looking at memes on YouTube and laughing at some frog peeing on somebody and say, oh, that represents socialism. We're working, Adam. We're talking to clients on the phone, arguing with people, yelling at the judge, getting yelled at by the judge, programming something in the computer that goes bippity bippity, and someone clicks on it, takes into produce delivery or something, and say, designed by Adam White at the bottom. Because we got jobs, Adam. We're grown men with jobs. We ain't got time to be saying, oh, look at this weird picture frog.
That was amazingly pressing there, because I earlier today was working with someone on a website where they were buying meat over the internet. I guess maybe that's it. But and then I realized, John, I started looking. I was doing the dishes earlier, and I stopped what I was doing. I pulled up the YouTube app on my phone. I hit the little trending button. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, why am I not? Because it's bugging me now. Like, why don't I understand what's going on in the world anymore? Like, how did I become an old man?
Because we got jobs, Adam.
I'm going through the list, and the things that are on the list are things that I would never in a million years click on, because I don't know why you would want to. So, like, first of all, like, there was the handful of things that were at the top of the list were like, they were all phrased like noun space reaction. And in the thumbnail to the video, and the thumbnails are really what makes me not click on any of these things, but I'm sure that they're all doing it because it's effective from like a, you know, that they have proof that people will click on these, but not me. But in any case, there's some guy's head that's in the corner making like an O face. And then there's a video screen next to him showing something. So I'm pretty fucking sure that these are videos that people are taking of themselves watching other videos and mugging while while the videos are happening. And but here's where the fear creeps in, John. I don't want to confirm my suspicion that that's what these things are, because if I do, YouTube is gonna know, and then it's on their list that I've watched the thing, and then it's gonna suggest more of those things to me, right? Because you know YouTube does that. You go, you watch, you know, John, you watch a bunch of you know, old footage of Gordon Lightfoot playing, and suddenly it's like, hey, you want to watch these other Gordon Lightfoot videos? And you're like, yes, I do, YouTube. Thank you. Right? It does that. That's how it works. I understand that. But if I go click on the top trending video and it's some guy making an O face and looking like a complete douche, reacting to some other video of some other guy looking like a douche, and then I click on that, it's going to know. And I'm pretty sure that that stuff now I'm sure of this. I'm pretty sure that that stuff is like 75% of what's on YouTube. So if I do that, it's going to know that I've looked at it, and then it's going to just bombard me with that stuff. And that fear, the fear of like tripping into some sort of like algorithmic jail, is preventing me from actually confirming any of my suspicions about how this YouTube culture works, because whatever I think it is, I'm pretty sure I will hate it.
Oh, you'll hate it.
But if I confirm that I'll hate it, it's going to give me more of it.
That's why
I need to put on a trench coat and go to the library and get on their computer
and look at memes.
Yeah. And confirm that all this shit is a thing. And I don't know why it's a thing. So, John, I mean, again, I'm not, I don't want to say that, like, you know, let's say you're a young person that's out there. Let's say you're a person under 30 and you get your kicks by watching YouTube videos.
Adam, you know what's funny is our definition of a young person is a person under 30. And just yesterday I was talking to a 25-year-old and she was like, I'm so old. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, I'm old compared to people in the music scene. I'm like, oh. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. So, So if you're one of those people under 30 who we're going to colloquially call a young person here, and you watch these things, Adam White, pass no particular judgment upon you. That's your culture. That's cool. I'm whatever floats your boat. You know, I hope it makes you happy. Great. I'm okay with that. My complaint isn't that this stuff exists. My astonishment is that so much of it exists and I am unaware of how much of a thing it is.
Well, I will pass judgment, and here's why.
I mean, if you're over 30 and you consume these as your regular culture, shame on you. But
yeah. Well, I will pass judgment, and here's why. It's a well-known fact within the punk news universe that I minored in Egyptology in college, and one of my biggest regrets was not majoring in Egyptology in college or classic and ancient Mediterranean studies. And one of the key gauges and one of the most accurate gauges of determining Egypt's prosperity, independence, and general wealth during the era is to look at their art. And without derivation, Egypt's most detailed, most detailed, elegant, and practiced and sophisticated art occurred during their most prosperous, their most free, and their largest expansion period. And when they started to fall due to droughts, due to the shrinkage of the Nile, due to foreign invaders, the art becomes much more cruder, much more cruder, cruder, and cruder, and cruder. And so when you look at Egyptian art, if it's not that refined, if it's not that well done, it's from a period where there's general decline in intelligence in the population, decline in wealth of the population, and decline in general sophistication of the population. And I fear that's happening now with YouTube culture. I look at, you know, what's the most popular thing right now? PewDiePie or whatever, you know. If you watch PewDiePie, it's him just like playing video games and him going, oh, that's how I bang my girlfriend, which I think is totally inappropriate because his viewers are like 10 years old, but whatever, except for he doesn't say bang, he said F, or he says the N-word or something. And then I look at what was like the most popular thing in like the 1800s, like Lord Byron, you know what I mean, or Charles Dickens, you know, or Melville, you know, and that's so much more sophisticated than PewDiePie, like playing Ninja Turtles and like making sex noises, you know what I mean? It doesn't bode well, Adam. It doesn't bode well.
Yeah, I mean, here are the top things that are on my top trending YouTube right now that that are not related to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. So this is the top thing right now. The thing that is above that on my list here, the top thing is something called Asian Jake Paul featuring Boy in a Band diss track, 6.3 million views. Then there's the next one, which says reacting to iDubbbz content cop on Jake Paul. And it's one of those things I talked to you about where someone's on the corner of it going, ugh! And then there's a video next to them, 3.3 million views. John, if we ever had 3.3 million people pay attention to anything that we've ever done, I'm pretty sure that we would retire.
Well, I can think of ways to get us more viewership, but I'm sure it won't go so well in the PR angle.
So I don't understand. Anyway, so yeah, I'm glad that it's you and me recording this, and that we don't have young person Ricky or younger person Sean on here, because they would try to rationalize this with some sort of horse shit that young people think, but they ain't here. So John, I'm a little bit disappointed that Tom Trauma hasn't joined us on this episode yet, because he could join in on the old person train here. But I say we make a pact right now.
Let's do it.
And that is that inevitably when Ricky or Sean asks to come on the episode after this one,
we kick him in the nuts
and explain this to us. We refuse outright to talk about
that. That sounds good. And all I'm going to do is point to late kingdom art. I'm going to say, look at this, Ricky. Look at this shitty picture of this priest. Look at it. Just look at it.
So there you go, young people. This is what we think. And we don't want your opinion.
Yeah. And so, along those lines, I'm going to play a song. We're going to play it, and then I'm going to talk about it. So check out this song. I think it's great.
Oh!
And we're back. Adam White, what did you think of that song?
It was amazing, John. It was almost as if I heard the whole thing and we didn't just skip 2 seconds in the recording.
What that was is that's off Ariel Pink's new album. The track is called Return of the Iceman. Some people know who Ariel Pink is, some don't. He's kind of, like, even though hipsterism isn't really a thing anymore, he's in that general milieu, if you will. His last album was called Pom Pom, which is an absolute masterpiece, which I'm still jamming. Pom Pom was complex, dark, and whimsical. Fantastic. His new album is called Dedicated to Bobby Jameson. Good, not as great. It's a little bit more mellow, a little bit more like his earlier stuff, if you will. The last track that I just played was called Return of the Iceman. And the reason I didn't want to tell you who it was is I didn't want you to have any preconceived notions because I think this track is really neat because it's kind of like Ariel Pink doing like hardcore punk and oi in his Ariel Pink style. So I think it's a super cool track. The problem being is not only do no other songs in the album sound like that, but actually that song is from the digital-only version. And I didn't know this because I bought the CD online. They mailed me the CD, but they sent me the digital version download. And that's not on the CD. They left the best song off the album, but I guess because it's kind of different than the rest of the album. Anyway, the point being is that's Ariel Pink's – well, it's called Ariel Pink doing the song Return of the Iceman. His new album's called Return of Bobby Jameson. Check out his one before that if you don't know him, called Pom Pom. Amazing album. The new album's pretty good, not as great. Let's get into today's news. Adam White, this surprised everybody, but it surprised me for multiple reasons. Tom Petty passed away. It was a shock to a lot of people because he was just doing a concert like a couple of weeks ago, and he was celebrating, I think, the 40th anniversary of the Heartbreakers or something along those lines. They found him unresponsive in his house. And it appeared he had a heart attack. He was breathing and had a pulse, but they weren't sure what condition he was in. They rushed him to the hospital. And it was erroneously reported by CBS and a couple other publications that he had died. He actually hadn't died. He was on life support, but it was clear he wasn't going to make it too long. So the doctors did a test. It turned out he had no brain activity. So the family made the decision to pull the life support, and he passed away within a day or so. It was a shock because no one had any idea that Tom Petty had any problems. And maybe he didn't have any health problems. Sometimes people just do have cardiac arrest, and there was no way to know it. What surprised me a lot and first of all, Tom Petty's good. I like Tom Petty. I got a lot of his albums. His greatest hits album is one of the best greatest hits album, and that every single track you're like, yeah, 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 and then you get to the end of the CD and it's over. You're like, holy crap, like every single song is a classic. Tom Petty's not my favorite artist, but I like Tom Petty a lot. I think he's got a lot of good music. What surprised me, Adam, a great deal is almost everyone in the punk community was like, oh, Tom Petty's so great, Tom Petty's so great. I was very surprised that Tom Petty got the thumbs up from the punk community, whereas other artists within the Tom Petty genre, if you will, you know, like if it was AC/DC, which is harder than Tom Petty, and I would say more punk than Tom Petty, at least sonically, I think the punkers would give that the thumbs down. But Tom Petty got thumbs up all around from outside the punk community, which I understood. But in the punk community, all the punkers were very pro-Tom Petty, and I don't mean that to disparage Tom Petty. I was just very surprised by that without further comment.
Yeah, I had that same reaction. And Tom Petty for me fell into this category of artists when I was in high school that were listened to by a group that I had, I guess, like a contentious relationship with.
Is this the same group that listened to 90s R&B hip hop that you hated for so long?
No. I wouldn't think so, just because this group would have been just like so homogeneously white that I can't imagine that what they were
into.
So
this was another group that you hated. So there was at least two groups in your high school that you hated.
I had a healthy amount of disdain for everyone, but I hid it very well. I was unsure when I was getting into music and I was in high school what my thing was going to be, like what was my jam, right? So when I started to get into indie music, get into a lot of this Canadian indie stuff, get into ska, and get into punk rock sort of by an extension of being in the ska, what I would notice was that a lot of the people that I would have like guys that I would have like a shop class with they wouldn't be mean to me, right? Like they weren't, there were definitely people that were, that were on like the adversarial end of my high school universe, right? But these weren't them. These are people that were just like other guys that were the most just like straight laced, you know, nothing controversial about them, you know, boys that were acting like they were older, right? Like the kid that you're in like ninth or 10th grade, but they're trying to conduct themselves like they're adults all the time. And they're not just like some awkward child monster, which is what you actually are at the time. And a lot of those people, what they were into was very, what I perceived as being very safe, straight laced rock and roll. So they weren't into anything that could be construed as like vaguely ethnic, because woo, like it wouldn't go there, right? And they definitely weren't into anything that you would consider aggressive or hard or anything like that. Like the furthest any of them would go would be like AC/DC, right? And not like interesting album cut AC/DC, just like, you know, whatever the hits on the radio are.
Back in AC/DC. Black.
Yeah, exactly, right? And but what these guys tended to listen to was in my head, they listened to, and this is where the Canadian part is going to come in, they listened to the Tragically Hip a lot. They listened to Tom Petty. I definitely noticed that the people of them that were a little bit more on the edge may have listened to like some greatest hits, Black Sabbath, right? But nothing too far down the down the album there. And in my head, Tom Petty was always just one of these, like, for years, like, oh, if you're not like some fucked up outcast, then that's your rock and roll. That's what you're gonna play when you're, you know, driving around in your pickup truck, going to the football game, kind of thing, right? And it took me a long time to clue in that like there was actually like a worthwhile artist or the worthwhile story that was there. And I mean, my vector into Tom Petty was the Traveling Wilburys, because through a bunch of weird circumstances I got into them, and of course he was one of them, right? And I remember when I was a teenager, it was like, it was a bit of a shock where I'm like, oh yeah, like I totally get why I like the Traveling Wilburys, right? Because hey, we got one of the Beatles that's in here. We got Bob Dylan that's in here. We got, you know, like Roy Orbison and Jeff Lynne and everything. We're like, yeah, okay, that's not anything anyone's into. But it took me a little while where I'm like, Tom Petty? I'm like, I don't, in my head, he wasn't one of those. He wasn't in that group. Like, he wasn't one of those peers.
But Jeff Lynne was. Jeff Lynne was, in your mind? If the listeners don't know, Jeff Lynne of Electric Light Orchestra, famous producer, as long as having some of the biggest hits on the radio ever through Electric Light Orchestra.
Jeff Lynne was enough of an unknown to me that I just took it
just some guy.
Took it as verbatim. Like, oh, it's some guy. Who's Jeff Lynne? And I would know. And I'm like, okay. Like, I don't listen to Electric Light Orchestra either, but whatever, right? But Tom Petty, I had the history with, because I knew all of Tom Petty's hits, right? Because, you know, all these people that were, you know, on the straight and narrow were listening to him, right? So I'd heard it, you know, again, I heard it, you know, on the radio in shop class 500 times and all that, right? So it took me a while to really wrap my head around that no, not only is what he's doing, you know, a completely artistically worthwhile thing, but he means a ton to people. And I still right up to his death here, it did not fully click into me how much that was the case, and how much just the universal outpouring of love towards him that we were going to see. And again, like people, like you said, all over the punk scene, you know, like music critics who I tend to think of as pretty eclectic music critics that, you know, in my narrow worldview, wouldn't be all that interested in what a Tom Petty is doing. We're all just like outpouring the love. And I was like, all right, I continue to live with the reverberations of my high school misconceptions to this day, because while I have no beef with Tom Petty or anything, I did not, I was not expecting that amount of outpouring.
Why do you think the punks love Tom Petty so much? Or
I don't know. I mean, I don't begrudge them or anything for it. I don't know. I mean, he's when you dig into it, he's got some pretty, you know, some pretty gnarly history. He's done some pretty rock and roll things and all that. But is that what the punks are going off of? I don't know.
I think what it is, as much as the punks love to pretend they don't like rock or classic rock, a lot of them actually do love it. And for some reason, it was safe to admit that with Tom Petty, because as we saw with Bruce Springsteen, Tom Petty has this narrative that's been built around him. I'm not sure that narrative is entirely true, but it's a good narrative to buy that, you know, Tom Petty represented the everyman and he was a cool guy. Let's not kid ourselves. Tom Petty was making millions and millions of dollars from flying around in private jets. Doesn't mean he was a bad guy, but he wasn't an everyman. But maybe because he came from everyman roots, as opposed to, say, I don't know, people assume that like AC/DC doesn't come from everyman roots when they certainly do. It's just the narrative that's been built around them. So I think that's why punks kind of give themselves a free pass when it comes to Tom Petty. And I say that as a Tom Petty fan. I learned an interesting, cool story about Tom Petty today. So after, I believe it was after his second album, his record label was sold to one of the bigger record labels. And he took offense at being sold like meat, to quote him. And so he didn't want to put out a record on the mega label under the terms of the smaller label that he was on. So what he did is he drove himself into debt by self-financing his record and then filed for bankruptcy. And Adam, do you know what happened? Well, you might not know. Do you know what happens when someone files for bankruptcy?
Vaguely, but no.
The contracts are voided. So he got out of his contract by purposely driving himself into bankruptcy, voided the contract, then recut a new deal with them at an agreement more favorable to him, because by that time he was famous. Now, that's the story. I don't know if it's entirely true, because if anybody knows anything about bankruptcy, you can't force – there's a bankruptcy look-back period in it, and if the bankruptcy trustee thinks that you purposefully drove yourself into bankruptcy for – reasons not permitted under bankruptcy law, then you don't get your discharge, which means you don't get it out of your contracts. However, that's the story, and maybe it is true. And that's pretty punk rock of Tom Petty, like kind of giving the middle finger to the big label that bought him by driving himself into bankruptcy and then cutting it. It's punk and it's gangster, because he drove himself into bankruptcy and then cut a new deal at more favorable terms. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've been hearing little stories like that all day that are like painting him in a different light than what I had assumed that he was in. So, if you were a Tom Petty fan, you know, my condolences, man. Sucks to lose.
And if you haven't checked him out, Greatest Hits. That's the place to start with Tom Petty. Greatest Hits.
All right, so John, we want to jump on to something here that you've been kicking around as a topic to talk about.
Yeah.
And we keep cutting it from the show, but because everyone else has abandoned us and we just have Reign of the Asylum here, let's talk about this.
Okay.
Bootlegs.
I love Discogs. If you haven't checked out Discogs, you should, although I'll get into this in a second. Discogs is an amazing website. The original idea of Discogs, I think, was basically just to list every pressing of every record. And if you go onto Discogs, it's insane how detailed the listings are. Like, you know, Beatles records will have 300 listings, 300 different pressings, you know. More modern stuff tends to be super accurate because it's being updated as those records are being released. So Discogs is a gigantic, multi-million entry database of different pressings of different records. Discogs' primarily second function, which now I think is its primary purpose, it's a great place to buy rare records or common records. Pretty much, I mean, not any record, but 90% of the records you want, you can buy on Discogs right now. You know, as a side note, Adam White, just recently I got a record off Discogs that I've been trying to get for 15 years. I've been trying to get a record. It's called a DBX, which is Dave Brocky Experience of GWAR, live at Ground Zero. It slipped through my fingers twice. And finally, Adam, finally, I was able to snap it up and I got it. And I think I've gotten every single one of my white whales. I don't have any white whales left in my record, you know, in my record collection. There's records I want, but no things that I really have to have. This was the last thing that I really, 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 really wanted to get. And now I got it.
See, there's a few of those for me still, and every once in a while, Discogs reminds me about, oh, hey, one of these is for sale, and I get the email, and I'm like, I can't do it price-wise.
Yeah, right?
But I mean, like, I've definitely you know, started to use it for that. I mean, the one thing that I started to use Discogs for more than anything.
Selling records, easy cash.
But you know what? Is that selling CDs. And that we've talked on this show before about how, I, as a person that was a music critic during our era, had acquired hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of CDs and then decided flippantly that CDs are dumb and I don't like them anymore and I don't want them in my life. Well, what Discogs has really proven to me, John, is that opinion is purely one that I've internalized and not really has any basis in reality.
Yes.
Because people want CDs. And it works out because people want my CDs. So I move a reasonable amount of CDs from my pile that I don't want in my house anymore. You know, 2-3 things a month seem to go out, and it just adds up into this little nest egg that I use to buy records that I want. So it all sort of works out. Discogs is great. So John, one of the things that I had on that list, on my Discogs for sale store there, was, speaking of Tom Petty here, a CD that I bought in a used store in the early 2000s that was called The Traveling Wilburys Volume 1/Volume 3. Now if you were a fan of the Traveling Wilburys, those were their two records. They released one called Volume 1 and one called Volume 3. And it was just, they're just being silly about it, right? Like that's why they just did it to be weird. But this was both of them on one CD. The album art was like their logo and then the art of the two original albums just thumbnailed below it. And the back of the CD had all this shit in Russian.
Yeah. You know, these CDs are famous, these kinds of CDs, you know.
Yeah. So I'm like, this is a weird thing. So I went and I listed what for sale because I'm like, hey, someone buy this weird Russian bootleg compilation of the Traveling Wilburys. And it was up there on the list. And then it got vanished on me by Discogs because it was a bootleg.
Yes.
And that's what you wanted to talk about.
Yes. And actually, as a side point, that record was out on a label called CD Maximum. CD Maximum is a huge Russian label that all they do is bootleg. And they always put two albums on one CD. But the weird thing is like for like bands that have like a big discography, they'll pick like two random albums like from totally different eras. Like there's Rolling Stones one where it's got one record from like 65 and then one record from like 83. It's just like a weird mix up, you know.
Well, I mean, so on that note, they have a CD Maximum?
CD Maximum. It's probably the biggest singular bootlegger in the world.
Yeah. So they have another Traveling Wilburys set, and this one is called Volume 2/Volume 4.5. Right? Now, Volume 4.5 is a legitimate bootleg Wilburys set. So I don't know the exact story behind it, but I don't know. It may be a live thing. It might just be outtakes or whatever, but it's a known quantity. Volume 2 doesn't exist, but what CD Maximum put on there as Volume 2 is Tom Petty's Full Moon Fever in its entirety, right? They just gave it the name Volume 2 and slapped it on here. And it is that album identically to the Tom Petty album, and it, which was in no means by any artist's intent meant to be the second volume of the Traveling Wilburys. That's just like this bootlegger was just like, throw it on there. We need to fill the space.
Classic CD Maximum. So anyway, the point being is for the longest time, you could buy, well, Discogs still lists bootleg CDs and records and whatnot. For the longest time, you could buy them. And I made a decent, and for some bands like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, collectors are willing to spend top dollar for bootlegs of those records. And I was selling a lot of those bootleg CDs, Pearl Jam's another one. boot on Discogs for good money. However, just recently, Discogs really clamped down, and not every bootleg sale has been knocked off, but I would say about 80% of bootlegs, Discogs will not allow you to sell. And the legal reason why, I mean, they didn't release a statement or anything, but the legal reason is Discogs, I think, is trying to become more and more legit. They're launching other platforms. There's now a comic book Discogs. There's a book Discogs. So under copyright law, distribution of a bootleg item makes you liable for copyright infringement. And even though Discogs doesn't sell the things, you can only post it there. I guess they're worried about secondary liability. So I think that's why Discogs is doing it. That being said, there's a real thorn in my side, both selling and buying, but mostly selling rare stuff. So now I got to go back to eBay and deal with those monsters and sell bootleg crap on eBay.
I would, of course, see them wanting to discourage someone going on there and selling a bootleg that, like, they are bootlegging, right?
Yeah, but that's not the case. They've knocked off,
it's like secondary market shit. Like, it's out there. Just let us, it's moving around between people in the marketplace. Just let it move.
I guess, from a legal standpoint, I can understand an artist wanting to not have bootlegs being sold because the release is not in their control. But from the other perspective, 99.7% of people buying bootlegs already have all the official stuff, and they're just buying bootlegs because they're hungry for more. You know what I mean? It's like, I think the effect on the market is minimal. And so it just sucks, man. Now I can't conduct my legal activity selling my rare bootleg CDs that I bought for $3 and sell them for, you know, $50, $60, $70 on Discogs, which is super easy, you know. The other thing is, Adam, I used to love eBay, and then eBay just got so crappy. Like, if you're – eBay is so oppressive – oppressive, you know what I mean, though. But eBay is so oppressive towards sellers now, and buyers don't understand that it's an auction. And they'll buy stuff, and even if it's as described, it'll be like, oh, there's a nick in the jewel case. I'm like, yeah, I put that in the ad. They still complain, and eBay always rules in favor of the buyer. That is, buyers on eBay have unrealistic expectations. I feel as though Discogs, which was a paradise for me for the past 3 years selling stuff, I feel buyers are getting a little bit more entitled, especially a certain segment of buyers. And I feel as though I didn't have any problems on Discogs for like 3 years. And then in the course of like 3 months, I had like three or four problems. I feel as though buyers on Discogs are getting worse, and it's becoming eBay part two, unfortunately. Do you agree?
I have thankfully never had a problem with a Discogs buyer. Now, that said, I've only sold CDs on it, and I've not sold any records on it, and I have a feeling that the record people are going to be more like persnickety about it. Like, they're going to be more combing for scratches and covers and things like that. Like, I feel like a lot of, like it's funny that you said jewel cases. I mean, like, I feel like a lot of the stuff that I've sold, like, I've listed and described it as like, this is used, dude. Like, this is a used thing. There was like someone that bought like a Banner Pilot CD or something from me. And I sent them a photo. I'm like, there is a scratch down the bottom of this, and I'm showing you it. Like, it is right here. It does not affect the play, but it's there, man. Like, is that cool? And all of them are just like, we love CDs. Give us the CDs. I'm like,
okay. Adam, who do you think is the most problematic buyer? The buyer who buys the normal item at normal price, you know, $8 for a 7-inch, $6 for a 7-inch, $15 for a record. The person that pays medium price for a semi-rare thing, $40 for a CD, $34 for a record. Or the person that buys the ultra-expensive CD or record, $100, $150. Who is the most problematic buyer?
I mean, the obvious one would be the buying the most expensive thing, but I'm sure that's not the
wrong
answer.
And the reason is, the person buying that is so happy to get, well, you tend to be more careful when you're listing a $100, $150 item, but they're so happy to get it, they just want to get it. They really, really want it. The most problematic buyers are the people that get stuff for cheap. They are always the biggest whiner. They are always the ones that complain. And that's just because they're stingy, and that's the kind of person they are. Second question, what genre of punk do you think whines the most about quality or description or valuation of record?
Oh, I'm just going to list the ones that you've tried to that have ground your gears the most. Well, which is it, John?
Beard Punk. They are. I sold a Hot Water Music 7-inch, and I said, listen, it's got dings on the thing. The record's fine. It's got dings. Kid gets it. He complains. It's got dings on the thing. I'm like, yeah, you asshole. I told you. I sold. This kid was a real creep. Like a $4 like slow death record. You know, he's like, it's got a thumbprint on it. I'm like, yeah, just take a freaking cloth and wipe it off, you asshole. It's a $4 record. You know what I mean? They are the worst. Beard Punkers are the worst. I'm sorry. They are. You know, I sold lots of heavy metal stuff. No complaints. Knock on wood. I sold hardcore stuff. No complaints. I sold lots of Grateful Dead stuff for different reasons. No complaints. The Beard Punkers. Ugh. Listen, speaking of people I can't stand, well, actually, speaking of people that have unrealistic expectations, I don't care about this guy, but speaking of people that have unrealistic expectations, I don't know if you have a whole lot to say about this. The Fyre Fest was the festival from earlier this year where this guy, what's his name, McFarlane, is it Bobby McFarlane? Billy McFarlane. He charged between $500 to like $10,000 a ticket. And you're supposed to get flown to this island to have an exclusive, like very expensive musical performance. He was wildly unprepared. The bands weren't paid. The island wasn't ready. And people were literally airlifted off the island like a scene from a Full Metal Jacket or Apocalypse Now. He got charged with fraud for wire fraud and also making false statements to a bank. He's claiming just this week that he's not guilty. He's 25-year-old and he's going to fight the charge. Adam White. Is it going to work out for this guy? And frankly, I'm sure this guy's only 25. That's pretty impressive. Like if when I was 25, I don't know if I'd be able to organize a multi-million dollar festival. You know what I mean? And when I was 25, I don't think I'd get a $3 million from a loan from a bank. You know what I mean?
No, that's kind of impressive. John, where did we get the picture that we run with? This article, is this like the guy's being chased by the paparazzi? Is that what's happening?
I just like poked around for pictures. I was being a little TMZ on this one, so I poked around to find like the most ridiculous picture I could find of him, and we've been using that one ever since.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, try not to do something that's going to end up with a fraud charge levied against you. But on the other hand, you know, I'm 35 and I haven't organized a music festival. So this guy's at least organized a failed music festival. I got to give him that.
Yeah. Is the moral of the story start small and build your way up, or is the moral of the story dream big?
No, the former. I don't know. I cannot put myself in a situation where I'm a 25-year-old and someone is going to give me access to any amount of $1 million, let alone any amount of $1,000, to do something risky. This is someone that just exists on a different, completely different pane of the social stratosphere than I've ever lived.
It's because we're wimps, Adam. I mean, when we threw the summer soiree, I'm like, oh man, I hope we sell all these tickets because it's $18 a ticket and I need to pay, you know, I'm worried about like $18 tickets and I'm like, oh man, I hope it sells out. And it did. And meanwhile, this guy's taking out $3 million like it's nothing. We're wimps, Adam. We're wimps. This is why we'll never be Martin Shkreli's. We don't have the balls.
Yeah, yeah. No one had to get hella lifted out of the summer soiree. So I guess we're not ambitious enough, John. We just gotta do things that can legitimately get.
Actually, people. Adam, you bring up a good point. Lately at my job, I have had some pretty wealthy clients, and I do think that is one of the traits of very rich people, in that they don't have, they tend to less have. Well, I don't want this person to get hurt. I don't want that person to get hurt. Like a big concern of the summer soirees, I wanted to make sure people got paid. I didn't want to have to deal with the issue is what if it craps out and I'm on the hook for like, you know, what I would call a significant amount of money. So that was a very big concern for me. In my experience, guys like this Fyre Festival guy, they don't think that way. They just think, let's gamble it all. They don't ask what will go wrong or what could go wrong. Or no, they don't ask what if it goes wrong. They say it's not going to go wrong. And they usually win, but this guy didn't, you know. I mean, look at Shkreli. Shkreli's an asshole, but he's super rich, you know.
Yeah, I guess. I got a feeling that when the universe is all finished having its way with Shkreli, we may not wish that we were.
We need to buy drugs, Adam, and jack up the prices. We'll start on the street. We'll start on the street level. We'll work our way up. We'll start buying street drugs, jacking up the price, and we'll go from there.
John, there are so many ways that we could be preying on our fellow man that we have not yet executed on. So from one controversy to the next here. So this just crossed our plate. So forgive me if this sounds a little bit like I'm going to read it, because I'm totally going to read it. But I saw an article over there in Exclaim that the band Zex, we need to recap people on who Zex were. Zex was the band that was mistakenly pressed onto the A side of
Beyonce's latest album.
Yeah, of Beyonce's Lemonade, and then sort of like gained sudden international prominence because of this quirky story where people that were buying this Beyonce record were getting this kind of like glam punk band out of Ottawa, Ontario on their record. And that was wonderful, and we all liked that and had a laugh. And then it turned out that that there was a long simmering number of rumors and allegations that had been levied against the band's guitarist and their label, which is Magic Bullet Records. All this sort of came to light with their sudden rise to prominence, and then the label dropped them. And then really the band and the guitarist, who's a guy named Joe, both of those things got dragged through the mud quite a bit. And it looked like it was a whirlwind 2 days in the world of Zex there, where suddenly this band that, you know, had a cult following in their scene, but no one in the rest of the universe had ever heard of, was in every major news publication as sort of a, you know, just like a soft news piece, but their name was everywhere because of this quirk of a manufacturing error. And then a day later, all of this apparent dirty laundry shows up and everything falls apart. Well, so this ain't done. So the guitarist, a guy named Joe Capital Side, that is not his real name, of course. Joe,
Adam, what do you think of the punk name Capital Side? Too obvious?
I mean, on the one hand, they're in Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada, but on the other hand, it doesn't roll off the tongue, John. It's no
Johnny Rotten, no Sid Vicious,
no Sid Vicious. It's no Jello Biafra, right? It's what it is. So anyways, Capital Side filed suit on October 4th against Magic Bullet Records, claiming that the band had been dropped due to, this is the quote, recent and ongoing accounts of alleged sexual assault, end quote, and routine boycotts by promoters, venues, and record stores. So, here's the actual quote here. He says, in light of ongoing recent accounts of sex... I keep reading the wrong quote here. Magic Bullets said this when they dropped them. They said, in light of ongoing recent accounts of alleged sexual assault tied to Zex guitarist Joe Capital Side, Magic Bullet Records is hereby dropping Zex from its roster of artists effective immediately. That's what they said. They've actually since deleted that statement, so that statement isn't on their website anymore. The label also cited firsthand information from the band's singer about some aspects of Capital Side's relationship. And I'm not going to reiterate because it was a little bit fuzzy even in the original statement. But so here's what Joe told Billboard magazine. He said, concerning the allegations of sexual assault on women made by our ex record label, Magic Bullet Records, I denounce them as false and have undertaken a defamation lawsuit this week for spreading false information about me and Zex. There are no charges laid on me. So he has said that. That is what he's going to do. So apparently there's a lawsuit now. It's been filed between him and Magic Bullet. I don't know where any of this goes.
Well, I'll tell you where. Because I know Billboard said there was a lawsuit filed, but where was it filed? I'm not sure. I mean, they could have got it right, but like an attorney didn't write this. I denounce them as false. That's not legal language. Denounce. Like, what is this, medieval England? Secondly, he says there are no charges laid again on me. That's not a requirement for defamation. What defamation is? It's an untrue statement said, what they call it, published, which means spoken to a third party, that is damaging to the person. So the problem that he's got here is the first defense to defamation, which is what you always go to if you're being sued, is truth. And so if I was his attorney, I wouldn't recommend that he file this lawsuit, because what Magic Bullet would hypothetically do is they're going to go right to the people that said he abused them or whatever, and say, well, it's true, he did abuse them, and here's the truth, we win, you know, in which case he loses money and his image is worse. Second, how much money is he hoping to get out of Magic Bullet? I can't imagine Magic Bullet has that much money. Third, I can't imagine this guy's that wealthy, so who is he paying? Like, maybe the attorney is working on contingency, but what attorney would work on contingency to sue a small record label? What money is there? You know what I mean?
Well, so, I mean, how does jurisdiction work in something like this, too? Because the Magic Bullet Records is an American label. Zex is a Canadian band. The allegations that were made were presumably made within Canada.
No. They were – well, good question. And the answer is where did the damage occur and the defamation occur? And the answer is the United States. So he would file in the – well, he would either file at the federal or state level, probably state level. So he would file in the state county where Magic Bullets is located, for two reasons. A, that way there's no venue argument. B, to execute, it's a lot easier to execute. He could sue in Canada, but so what? Then if he wins in Canada, then he has to transfer the judgment from Canada to the United States, which is a pain in the ass, and then it gets challenged again upon transfer. You know, so why didn't Billboard say where it was filed? It sounds like to me he just said, oh, I'm going to sue, but I'd be interested. Or maybe an attorney sent a letter to Magic Bullet to say, we're going to sue you. Like we need more info before we can really understand what's going on here, you know?
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, the more you analyze it, the weirder it seems. Yeah, the other thing too is that Magic Bullet Records, you were more aware of them than I was prior to this story coming on. So they're not they're not an insignificant label. They're not a tiny label, but all things being relative here, there's still a punk rock.
Yeah, I'm right? Pretty sure the guy that runs it has a day job. You know what I mean? So
yeah, so the records that they are releasing for Zex, how much of a financial, like, how much of a contractual agreement would those two have really had together? Well, would they have signed Zex for a several album deal with a retainer? Like, if Magic Bullet Records decides to drop them, I would almost want to have that in quotes. One of the things that I keep finding with a lot of these small labels is that they're sort of foregoing, you know, these aren't, you're not signing to to MCA in 1996 or something, right? Like, they're generally doing one-off deals with bands, or, you know, maybe short-term deals for more than one record. But it's not like you have it's not like because you're a band that gets signed to Magic Bullet Records, you have you don't get a $60,000 advance and a 5-album deal or something.
Yeah, but the point of the lawsuit wouldn't be to void it. I don't think they have any record contract, or if they did, it was on a per-release basis. But he would be suing the damage to his reputation, which is independent of the contract itself. So if he could say, listen, everyone hates me now, I'm not, no one's buying our records now, no one will book us now, you could show significant damage that way. We're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. You know what I mean? So that's what he would be going after. But the point is, like I said, you got execution problems. How much money does Magic Bullet really have? You got the truth problem. And that, if I was Magic Bullet, that's what I'd go to real quick. I'd say, listen, it's true. You know what I mean? In which case, then this guy's got problems on his hands. But like I said, and this is not unusual from non-legal sources. They're missing a lot of important info here. Where was it filed? Who was it filed against? Was it filed against Magic Bullet, or was it filed against the owner of Magic Bullet? We don't have any of this, you know? So tough to say.
So anyways, that story ain't done. It's going to keep
I'm interested in this story, but like I said, I would not have advised the lawsuit, but you know.
So let's here. I'm gonna play a song, and then we'll pop back, and we'll talk about a few other things. So, John, this weekend, Friday night, I'm headed up to Toronto. Ooh. To see the first of two record release shows from the band Tough Age, from originally from Vancouver. They moved to Toronto. They have a record called Shame that's coming out on Mint. We played a song from them last week or the week before on this show. So on the Friday night show, Tough Age is playing with a handful of bands. One of them that they're playing with is a band from Brooklyn called Future Punks. And John, have you ever sat down and listened to Future Punks before? And I say punks by, there's an X, P-U-N-X, right? So Future Punks are doing an incredibly fun, almost over the top, but I can't stop listening to it once I start. Devo riff, where basically they're embracing the, you know, we're gonna play you punk rock from the future, which means there's gonna be, you know, a lot of stereotypical future stuff. There's gonna be synthesizers and weirdness and bleeps and boops and things like that. So they had a record that was called This Is Post Wave that came out in 2015, so they're due for something new coming out. But anyways, this song is off This Is Post Wave. It's called Grand Scheme, and it's super fun. So here you go. This is Future Punks out of Brooklyn.
Turn away, 'cause we can't see. to your face. Who is the pointer? What is her name? How can she get here? How can she leave? Does she know how to awake from the dream? And can she?
We're back. That was Future Punks.
Future Punks.
All right. Let's talk. We'll talk about a few things. A few things that happened this week that you might want to know about here. The first one is that Mr. Tom DeLonge out of X from Blink-182, of the Blink-182 principles. This is the one that is chasing aliens and you know, emailing John Podesta and getting involved in the 2016 election.
That was my point of this article, Adam, is like, if you know, at Punk News, it says recent articles about this artist. And if you look at Tom DeLonge, it's hilarious. It's Tom DeLonge released new book. Tom DeLonge helps locate alleged predators. Tom DeLonge has been sending emails about UFOs to Clinton official. It's like Tom DeLonge, he's a pretty interesting guy.
God bless him. He's got a hobby. So anyways, he's going to be releasing a new book in the novel series, young adult novel series that he is writing, which is called the Poet Anderson series. So this one, which is going to be called Poet Anderson in Darkness. It's due out on January 30th, 2018. It's co-written by Suzanne Young. It follows the adventures of the titular poet Anderson as he ventures into the astral plane to save his brother, who is currently in a coma. I feel like we run Tom DeLonge stories sometimes to mock them, or at least people perceive that we're to mock them. But I think I'm past the mocking stage. I'm just sort of... I'm fascinated.
I'm peeling this onion back to see how many layers there are. I mean, Tom DeLonge, listen, a lot of the guys that get rich off a couple of hits, they kind of just sit back and don't do anything. Tom DeLonge is doing stuff, man. He's catching predators. He's writing about UFOs to presidential officials. He's writing stories about astral. He's up to stuff, man.
He's going to be the one that saves us all. So anyways, that's out there if you're a fan of his particular brand of nonsense. So there's a cool little split that we learned about this week. Something coming out on Blacktop Records, which is run out of Tillsonburg, Ontario. John, you are Tillsonburg, Ontario.
Oh yeah, man, I go there every summer.
You do not know the Stompin' Tom Connors song Tillsonburg?
I don't even know who Stompin' Tom Connors is.
Holy shit. All right. So you don't know who Stompin' Tom Connors is. My God, John, it's like you're not a Canadian person. Anyways, Tillsonburg, Ontario is famous for being in a goofy folk song by Stompin' Tom Connors, who is a goofy Canadian folk artist that sang a lot about Canadian stuff. Right.
Isn't that like 90% of Canadian artists?
He is the patron saint of them. The man was a national treasure. He wrote tons of songs about like this or that geographical location and the particular quirk. So the song about Tillsonburg was about how Tillsonburg is a town that exists because there's lots of tobacco fields there. And if you're living in Tillsonburg, you're working the tobacco fields and you got a sore back from having to pick that tobacco. So anyways, I'm sure that that's not necessarily the case right now with Tillsonburg, but shit, I've driven through there. There's tobacco fields. Anyways, though, that's where Blacktop Records is located. Blacktop, they're releasing a split soon from Kevin Seconds of 7 Seconds and Steve Soto of The Adolescents. There's no word yet on what the title is or the track listing really or anything like that, but you can probably find more on blacktoprecords.ca when it's ready to come out. But the kind of cool thing is that Kevin Seconds went and posted some studio footage of him and Steve noodling away on some of the material. So that very likely means there'll be more of that. So if you you go follow Kevin Seconds on Instagram there, you should be able to check this out. So, you know, here's two old punk guys doing a thing together. The two of them recently toured, so this is sort of a follow-up to that, I think.
Yeah, but have they been talking with any Clinton officials about UFOs? That's what I want to know.
You know, it's just no one is ambitious as they should be.
Right, well, how many,
we're not organizing, you know, fucking island music festivals. Kevin Seconds isn't inserting himself into the political happenings of the day. It's just, what can you do, John?
Well, here's what you can do. You can kick back with some groovy island-inspired music. The Long Beach Dub All-Stars. They're back because so many people were asking for it.
It's like, they're back. Everyone's like, what?
Of course, Long Beach Dub All-Stars is the band that formed out of the remains of Sublime when Sublime mastermind and leader Bradley Noel passed away. The current incarnation of the band does not include any members of Sublime, namely Bud Gow or Eric Wilson. It does include, I guess, what you call Sublime associates, Marshall Goodman, Miguel Happel, and Opie Ortiz, as well as Jack Manns, Tim Wu, and Edwin Campworth and Roger Rivas. This is their first new music since like 2001, I think, from their second album. Long Beach Dub All-Stars also broke off into Long Beach Short Bus, which was kind of a hit Grateful Dead kind of thing. Anyway, this is the first new music by Long Beach Dub All-Stars in about 12 years. Two new songs. They've got a couple of shows coming up. I don't know. I don't want to be too much of a hard ass on this, but I just... Well, I don't see a purpose of this. I mean, like, I love Sublime. I'm a Sublime maniac. But to me, Long Beach Dub All-Stars just seem to be Sublime without the cleverness, the balls, or the punk angle. It's Sublime without all the stuff that made Sublime special.
John, I reviewed the first Long Beach Dub All-Stars record on May 22nd, 2001.
Damn.
There you go. That's how long I've been doing fucking punk news shit. I definitely, at one point in my life, was, I wouldn't say a fan per se, but like I was following what this band was doing, and they frustrated me then because, I had no problem with people that were in and around the Sublime scene picking up and continuing on with that sound if they were into it, but on an execution standpoint, they seem to have all sorts of stumbles on those early records to me. There were just too much DJ shit on there, John. Like there was too much leverage, I guess, of trying to, or too leverage isn't the right word. There was too much reliance on trying to make the songs clever by tweaking them in the studio and not just relying on the fact that, you know, a lot of these guys could probably just play decent ska songs if you just stop goofing around with it. And I would never expect to have heard this band again, given that we have Sublime with Rome now, and that just sort of seems to, you know, fill the same void of what Long Beach was trying to do. But hey, they're back. And you know what, John? And now I'm going to temper this recommendation on the fact that I listened to these songs, I want to say 30% of both of them, as I was sitting on the call with John an hour ago. So I've not had much time to process this, but my initial read on this new material is how much it sounds like the Slackers, which is a band that I very much like. So given that I like the Slackers and this sounds like the Slackers, I suppose I can't be too negative on this stuff. The band sounds like they're playing that like second wavy kind of ska, that Slackers Hepcat, that throwback, sound that emerged out of the third wave there. So hey, I like that. I like that sound. So I guess I'm okay with this. I'm gonna say I'm okay with this.
You heard it here first. John. Adam White is a gigantic Long Beach Dub All-Stars fan. He's got the shirt. He's got the hat. You know, he's got the book bag, the lunchbox. He's a maniac. He just can't get enough of that. That California easy groove music.
I guess. I don't know.
Well, listen, I'm not going to hate on these guys too much. I don't think they're doing it for money. I don't think there's a whole lot of money to be had in Long Beach Dub All-Stars, honestly. So they're probably just doing it for the fun of it. And yeah, listen, have fun, kids. That's what life's all about. Having fun now, and scamming people for their drug money.
Now, is there, do you think, a rivalry now between them and Sublime with
Rome? I do not, and here's why. I think Long Beach Dub All-Stars reached out to Sublime with Rome and asked for permission. And of course, Sublime with Rome is, as people like to say, only 33% of Sublime, but two-thirds of the original lineup of Sublime with Rome, mind you. Their press release says that Eric Wilson could not be part of it. Or Bud, who's in Sublime with Rome? Is it Eric Wilson or Bud Gow? I don't know. Whichever one of those two is still in Sublime with Rome, they said he couldn't be in the band due to his commitment, but they're continuing onward. So I think they reached out for permission because let's be real. I mean, if the Sublime boys really wanted to slap down Long Beach Dub All Stars, they probably could, you know?
It is a. It's shocking how much reverberation there still is from Sublime.
They're a great band. I mean, they are. Like, I was recently listening to the Sublime box set. Like, it's got like three CDs of all rarities. Man, Sublime is so good. They don't get their they get credit in that they've sold a billion records and they're, you know, you can get a Sublime T-shirt at Target or Hot Topic, but within the punk and independent music community, they just do not get enough credit. They're so clever, they're so good, and they're so punk with their punk songs. Man, Sublime is great. I'd love Sublime, Adam. I'd love Sublime.
You should start a tribute band, John. That's what people do. You just you continue their sound for the. For the new era.
You think it's fun being in Bad Fish, or do you think it's like super depressing?
I feel that like at some point, do you
go cold inside?
Do you ask yourself, do you ask yourself, is everything that you're doing artistically dictated by this one flash in a pan era that you can no longer escape from, or do you maybe revel in that as like the inheritor of that sound? Because the weird thing about it is that my biggest problem with Sublime is I have heard dozens of local bands in my area, and I imagine that if it's there in my area, then everywhere else that. We're inspired by Sublime and are fucking horrible.
Right? I don't think I've ever heard a band that was good that was inspired by Sublime. You know what I mean?
There are legions of to this day. Like, and what I find is that like the further you get from the Sublime, they more become like sort of like half inspired by Sublime, half inspired by like I don't know, fucking 311, yeah. Right? Where like you the further you get. The worse these bands tend to be, and like never one of them that's been any good. And
I'm saying, it's just imagine being, you know, the guys in Bad Fish are like 45 or 50. Imagine it's like, well, we got to play another college bar and do Santeria or What I Got. You know, I'm 50. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and we got to do What I Got to a bunch of drunk 19-year-olds. Here we go. All right, everybody, let's have fun. But maybe they love it, man. Maybe they're the kind of guy – like, look at Lemmy, man. Lemmy never got tired of partying. Maybe the guys in Bad Fish just love to party. Adam, do you think you would ever get tired of partying? Like, if you were, like getting jetted around, North America, going to show after show, club after club, people say, oh, Adam, we love you. We think you're great. Would you get tired of that, you think?
I hope no. if only because I feel that like expressing that I'm tired of it would set me down a path of becoming one of these very insufferable internet people that talks a lot about how introverted they are in public. Do you have these people in your life?
Oh yeah, where, yeah. I know what you mean.
Where a major they will spend a great amount of time and energy projecting to the world how sensitive and introverted they are, which, like, I'm as a person who is personally, I think, sort of introverted. The last thing that I want to do is project my shit to strangers to find out what they think about it, right? But there's a whole universe of people, John, that's what they do. And I am worried that if I got tired of the party, then I would become this completely insufferable, self-referential person that does nothing but make art about how they're tired of success. I don't want to do that.
So you'd be Roger Waters.
Yeah. All right. So I think we have wrapped the amount of crap that we have to talk about on this show. Thanks to Tom Trauma for not showing up. I guess Tom had internet. Tom had computer problems. If anyone wants to send Tom $9,000 or so to update his rig, you can PayPal that to adam@punknews.org, and I'll make sure to give him it. If you want to send us mail, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. John, do we have anything else we want to part on here?
Listen, and no thanks to the kids with their blippity bloop YouTube channels talking about Twitch and I don't know, alt-right meme frogs with hats and shit. Cut it out. Just cut it out. Just stop. Just stop.
Yeah.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@valorundergroundstudios.com.